Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, April 19th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital and its Saratoga Medical Group, with more than 30 specialty practices, including palliative care, geriatric care, podiatric surgery, and women's primary care, saratogahospital.org. Joining us for Medical Monday is ear, nose, and throat doctor Jordan Gruby of Albany Medical Center. Dr. Gruby specializes in a range of ENT disorders for adults and children, as well as rhinology, nose, and sinus problems. Promises to be a fascinating program, so if you have a question, call early. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpopwamc.org. Your ENT calls coming up. Should be a groovy show. Groovy show. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Medical Monday today, and today we talk about ear, nose, and throat care with Dr. Jordan Gruby of Albany Medical Center. Dr. Gruby specializes in a range of general ear, nose, and throat disorders for both adults and children, as well as rhinology, nose and sinus problems, and endonasal cranial-based surgery used to treat skull-based disorders like pituitary tumors and cancers. Dr. Gruby was fellowship trained at Rutgers New Jersey Medical Center, a school that is, and completed his residency in head and neck surgery and facial plastic surgery. He received his doctoral degree from the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. Dr. Gruby now sees patients at Albany Med ENT on New Scotland Avenue in Albany. If you have a question for Dr. Gruby, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jordan Gruby, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ray. Thanks for having me.
You know, I often ask this of doctors on Medical Monday. What led you to this specific specialty?
It's a great question. I'm kind of biased, but I really truly believe that otolaryngology, or the field of ear, nose, and throat, is truly one of the best fields in medicine. I knew early on I wanted to do something procedurally based, so something that had some component of surgery. But ENT is kind of unique in the sense that, unlike other surgical fields, we treat patients medically as well, and we have the ability to treat patients without doing surgery. So in addition to that, it's a truly diverse field. We see patients from all age groups. We see males and females, children to adults, and into geriatrics. So you really kind of get the full breadth of patient population. And additionally, we do things that are extremely simple and routine, and consequently, we also do things very complex. So it kind of keeps you on your toes, and it's truly just a great field.
You know, aside from finding it extremely difficult to say, I'm fascinated by this concept of endonasal cranial-based surgery. And tell me about how this has advanced over the years. I assume with miniaturization of technology, things are a little easier today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a tremendous field, and it has seen great advances as technology has advanced over the last, I'd say, about 20, 25 years. The advent of something called the endoscope and endoscopic technology really, truly was revolutionary in how this field has advanced. Historically, to take out a tumor such as a pituitary tumor, this used to be a large surgery, either done through open incisions at the turn of the 19th century. Eventually, it kind of went into the microscope, but the endoscope has truly made it minimally invasive. So everything we do is through the nose. When we're in the operating room, only the nose is exposed. And I'm the access surgeon, so I get access to the skull base, and then I work as a team with the neurosurgical colleagues, and they're able to take out tumors. And there's no cuts on the outside, and it's truly remarkable.
Many of these specialized surgical fields now utilize, to some extent, robotic technology. Are you doing that?
So the field of otolaryngology has enacted some utilization of the robots. More so, our head and neck cancer surgeons utilize this for tumors of the base of the tongue and deep in the back of the throat, which was historically very difficult area to access. In terms of my specialty, we haven't really used the robot a ton, but we do get training in the robot in our otolaryngology training. And like I said, our head and neck oncology partners generally use that the most.
We are joined today on this Medical Monday by Dr. Jordan Gruby of Albany Medical Center, and we talk about ear, nose, and throat care today. And let's go right to the phones, 800-348-2551. Alan in Pittsfield, you're on.
Yes, hi. Doctor, is there a treatment for tinnitus, ringing of the ear?
Hi, Alan. Thank you. Thank you for your question. And tinnitus is a truly difficult thing to manage. It can be multifactorial. It's a great question. And usually the workup of that starts out with a hearing evaluation, so an audiogram. And it can be something as simple as hearing-related changes that are happening as you get older. And a lot of times what we offer patients like this is masking therapy. So sometimes hearing aids, if you do have a degree of hearing loss, can help. Sometimes we do offer patients some type, you know, some vitamins and some other things that help restore some of the blood flow to the inner ear. But it can be a very, very challenging issue for patients. But generally the workup starts with the formal audiogram and usually an evaluation of the ear itself. But it is a very difficult problem that we have here in otolaryngology in terms of fixing it.
Thank you very much.
Alan, thanks a lot for the call. It's Medical Monday with Dr. Jordan Gruby of Albany Medical Center. The number is 800-348-2551. Mary is in Glenmont. Hiya, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hi, Dr. Gruby.
You're on.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
I have had two surgeries for polyps, and I have aspirin sensitivity. As soon as 3 months after each surgery, they grew back. I have a loss of smell. I don't smell anything, and I have trouble breathing through my nose. And I'm wondering if you know of any new remedies for this problem.
Yeah. So aspirin exacerbated respiratory disease is one of the most challenging type of polyp issues within rhinology to fix. But we do have some exciting new therapies, and some of which are offered by my colleagues here at Albany in the allergy and immunology department. So there are some biological medications that have come out that are indicated for nasal polyps, and that has, after surgery, that has been found to be significantly helpful in reducing the polyp burden. We also have steroid-eluting stents that are now available to us that deliver steroid medications for a month to 3 months after surgery that help to keep the polyps at bay. Polyps generally respond very well to steroid therapy. It's just very difficult to keep patients on oral steroids for a prolonged period of time based on some of the side effects. So this new medication that I'm referring to is called Dupixent. Like I said, it's a biological medication. It's a twice a month injection, and it has been found, in my experience, to help a lot with patients with refractory polyps.
Oh, okay. That's good to hear, because I went to Boston, and they tried to desensitize me to aspirin, but
yeah.
I ended up with stomach ulcers.
Yeah, so that's,
so
I mean, desensitization to aspirin is actually, can be great, but it is not without, you know, potential issues, and that is one of the big ones. So the problem is not many people can tolerate that therapy, but there are other options now, and specifically Dupixent therapy.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. It's Medical Monday today. Ear, nose, and throat doctor Jordan Gruby of Albany Medical Center joins us, and our number is 800-348-2551. Let's grab one more before our first break. Jim in Matamoros. Jim.
Can a chronic maxillary sinus infection produce a heavy mucus lining in the nose, almost approaching a pseudomembrane status?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So you've had surgery before, sir?
No, not really. I got kicked in the face by a horse about 40 years ago, and that fractured my upper incisor teeth, and I think that's producing the maxillary sinusitis.
Got you. So, yeah, you probably have a degree of obstruction of the maxillary sinus, probably from that previous trauma. I would have to evaluate, you know, what your actual anatomical imaging looks like with a CAT scan. But oftentimes surgery opens up the drainage pathway of the sinus, and it allows the delivery of topical medications to that area. So you can get things like steroid rinses and steroid sprays, as well as antibiotic rinses into the affected sinus. So generally surgery becomes indicated for something like that. But like I said, I would have to, you know, actually evaluate your imaging and what the degree of obstruction is.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. We'll take a quick break here. It's Medical Monday with Dr. Jordan Gruby of Albany Medical Center. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop, it's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. We're joined today by Dr. Jordan Gruby of Albany Medical Center, and back to the phones we go. Dan in Albany. Dan, you're on.
Yes. Hey, Dr. Gruby, thank you. I fly occasionally, and the takeoffs are fine, but I experience intense ear pain with the landings. So what would be the cause of that?
So you're likely experiencing some eustachian tube dysfunction. So eustachian tube is the tube that connects the ear to the back of the nose. And this is the tube that works to equilibrize the pressures. And oftentimes going up and down on an airplane is something that could exacerbate that. And it could just be some degree of inflammation that you have around that area, or the tube just doesn't work kind of as good as it should. But what I would recommend for somebody like yourself who flies a lot, especially just to see if it helps, I would use something called Afrin, which is a nasal spray. And that's something that is decongestant, a powerful decongestant for the nose. And you only want to use it sparingly because your nose can actually become conditioned to it. But I would see if that helps. I would use two sprays in each nostril before you fly or even before you land. It works actually very, very quickly. So as you're, I guess, going to be making your descent, you could try to use that spray and see if that kind of pops open the tube so that it allows equilibration of the pressures as you go up and down.
That's over the counter?
That's over the counter, yes. Yep.
Okay, well, thank you.
You got it. I would give that a try. No problem.
Thanks, Dan. And that's a different, chemically different than Flonase?
Yes, so they work completely different. Afrin is a decongestant nasal spray. It's, like I said, it's a very powerful decongestant. It works almost immediately. Fluticasone or Flonase is a medication that is a steroid medication, so it actually works completely different. That's a medication that you need to use consistently for at least 2 weeks to get any benefit from it, and optimally up to 4 to 6 weeks to see how well you'll benefit. But they have completely different mechanisms of action. And like I said, Afrin nasal spray you have to be very careful of because people can actually become addicted to it, meaning that their nose will never decongest if they use it chronically. So if you use it over for like 1 or 2 weeks straight, you have to be very, very careful. So I tell people to use it sparingly, but it's a powerful decongestant, so it works really, really well.
It's Medical Monday. We're joined today by Dr. Jordan Gruby of Albany Medical Center. The number is 800-348-2551. And Tracy's in Cobleskill. Hi, Tracy, you're on.
Hello, yes?
Yep.
Last year, I fell down on the ice. You're not supposed to do that when you're 69 years old. I hurt my back, but later on, I realized that I have this constant tinnitus or tinnitus. You talked about that earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's one frequency. It's constant. Some people at WAMC would like to hear that I leave the radio on all night.
Oh, boy. Oh, so you're a glutton for punishment.
Good
for you.
Get a little background.
Great.
Yeah, like I said this earlier. Sorry, what were you going to say, Tracy?
I've been sent to an ENT specialist and a neuropathy specialist and a neurologist. And nobody seems to know, like, well, what do you do about it?
When you went to see that ENT doctor, did they do a formal hearing test for you?
They did.
And like I said, it can be very, very troubling. Oftentimes it's unfortunately relies on masking agents. So like you kind of had said, either leaving the radio on at night or some people just use fans, or there's other some other over-the-counter products that you can get or things online that are masking agents. But in lieu of like a significant hearing loss, it can be very, very troubling. And it's one of the things that we have in ENT, which there's just no great cure for. We always want to rule out some organic process, something that we can fix. But after that's all kind of ruled out, and it's just kind of idiopathic, or we don't have a great explanation for it. It's unusual that it was exactly related to your trauma, it can be a very, very troubling complaint.
I'm not sure about the trauma. Of course, I had to protect my ears in loud spaces as a carpenter and so forth.
Right.
But it seems like it just came after that injury.
Did they say that you were potentially a candidate for any hearing aids?
Well, no. You know, I can hear the peepers. I can hear the cardinal singing. I can.
Okay.
When the cicadas come out, I'll hear them.
Yeah.
There are certain frequencies that kind of, because I listen to music, I play music, sometimes there are certain frequencies they actually hurt.
Interesting. Yeah. Did you ever have any imaging of your head or of your ear?
Well, they've done a couple MRIs lately. I have a fingernail size thing in my left auricle.
Huh. I'll be darned.
Interesting. Yeah. Sometimes MRIs can be great, but also sometimes CAT scans are very useful to make sure that the structures of the inner ear, which are very, very obviously small and intricate. So you have to do very, very dedicated and specific scans to help look at the structures there. And that could be another route to go. Like I said, we always want to rule out anything organic, something that we could potentially fix. And then once all that kind of has been ruled out, we kind of are left with whatever the end result is. And like I said, sometimes it's masking agents, but there's no good quick fix, unfortunately, for tinnitus. I wish we had one. I wish there was a pill or a vitamin that we just could give you to fix it. But I would go back to your ENT doctor and see if they have any other ideas. There's also ear specialty doctors here in Albany Med that just focus on issues with the ears. So that would be another route to go to see somebody, you know, a subspecialist that just is focused on ear-related pathology.
Tracy, thanks a lot for the call. It's Medical Monday today. We talk ear, nose, and throat care with Dr. Jordan Gruby of Albany Medical Center. Before we go to the next call, what do you know of the origins of the name tinnitus? I'll tell you this. I've been in radio 34, 35 years, and I use headphones every day. And so anytime I'm in a very quiet room, there's the ring. I have it. And to me, it always seemed like, okay, you got a tin ear. You have tinnitus. But is there another origin of this name that every doctor I've talked to says tinnitus, but it sounds like tinnitus to me?
Yeah, you know, I don't know the origin or the historical context of it, to be honest with you, but it's a great question. And, you know, we can already see just from the couple of callers that this is something that we see very, very frequently, and it can be extremely bothersome to patients. But I don't know the historical context of it.
Well, that's your homework for the next show. Next time you're on, let's go back to the phones. And Jill is in Longmeadow. Jill.
Yes, good afternoon, doctor. I was wondering if there is any correlation between wisdom teeth, especially, of course, the two upper wisdom teeth. Mine are impacted with excessive fluid and wax in my ears.
Interesting question, although I don't think that they're related in general. Sometimes there can be a lot of masqueraders for ear pathology in the mouth. So you can have some pain, like sometimes a sore throat could cause some irritation, or you feel irritation in the ear or some fullness in the ear. Oftentimes when we take tonsils out of kids, they actually complain of ear pain, but their ears are normal. So there can be some crossover in some of the nerves that sensory nerves can overlap. But in terms of wax itself, that there should be no relation to your wisdom teeth being impacted.
What about the excessive? I've noticed that I get a lot of fluid in my ear. I don't have ear canals, loss, but
yeah.
Yeah, there's extra fluid. So I was just, and this is pretty recent. It's just happened maybe within the last 8 months or so. I was just wondering what causes that and what maybe I could do about it.
Do you use Q-tips in the ear?
No, my primary care has told me never to use Q-tips.
Uh-huh. No, I don't.
I would back in.
I would echo that. So sometimes what I was referring to is sometimes patients that do use Q-tips a lot can actually abrade and kind of irritate the canal wall lining, which actually causes issues and can cause some drainage and some chronic issues and irritate patients. So that could be a big one. But I think you should have them take another look into your canal itself and see if there's anything obvious within the canal that would be causing any drainage. You want to make sure that the eardrum itself is intact and you don't have for some reasons you could have chronic infections in the ear, and that has to obviously be evaluated. But so I would make sure that your eardrum is okay and there doesn't look to be any pathology within your middle ear, but also to make sure the canal doesn't look overly irritated. You can get some just chronic irritation to the canal just from any like dermatitis that you could get anywhere in your skin. So that would be something that they should look at, and that can cause some wetness and some drainage. But another good thorough exam probably would help kind of elucidate that.
Jill, thanks so much for the call. It's Medical Monday today with Dr. Jordan Gruby of Albany Medical Center. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And we go to Cindy and Troy. Cindy, you're on.
Yes, several years ago, I had a severe case of bronchitis. And ever since then, when I sing, my voice cracks. And I was wondering what would cause this. And maybe I've waited too long to have anything done, but is there something that could be done about it?
Well, I don't think you waited too long necessarily. So voice crackness or dysphonia, any change to your voice is what we would call that, could be related to that incident you had of bronchitis where you had a lot of coughing or something like that. But really, first and foremost, what you needed is an examination. So we have the ability in the office, any ENT, but specifically here, we even have voice-related specialists here in Albany. And what they would do is take a look down at your vocal cords. So when we look at your vocal cords directly, we have special scopes that go through your nose and high-definition video towers so we can get great visualization of those areas. And we want to make sure that the vocal cords themselves work and function that they work the way that they're supposed to. And also we want to look at if there's any lesions or any scarring or anything like that that could be precipitating some of that vocal fatigue and hoarseness that you have. But I think it's something that, especially if it's been going on for quite some time, should definitely be evaluated directly with observation.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Cindy, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551, the number. Jennifer in Warwick, New York. Hello, Jennifer, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A question I have relates to my hearing. I had a surgery on my shoulder, and for some reason, when I woke up from it, I couldn't hear out of my left ear. And this has been about 4 years, and the last ENT doctor I went to said that he wants to do a brain MRI. And I was just wondering why he would want to do that.
Sure. So sometimes when you have something what's called asymmetric hearing loss, so one ear or one ear isn't functioning as well as the other, so the two ears are kind of there's asymmetry right there in terms of the hearing capability. So the one thing that as ENT doctors that we're most concerned with or we want to make sure we rule out is that there's no tumor that's related to the hearing nerve itself. And that would be something called an acoustic neuroma. And the way that we do that is to look with an MRI. So that would be the reason, because one ear is different than the other, that kind of raises our index of suspicion that we want to make sure that we rule that out. And they're actually very, very rare, but it's something that we want to make sure of.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Sure.
Dr. Jordan Gruby joins us today on the program. And Mary's in Del Mar. Hello, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Good, you're on.
Good.
Hi. About a week ago, I had to have some sort of fancy imaging for some dental surgery I'm going to be having, and the tooth is right along my cheekbone. So in the imaging, the surgeon said he said, your sinus has a lot of bone in it. And almost, he said, it almost looks like redundant bone. And I said, okay. And he said, so I don't know, maybe see an ENT person. So I'm not sure what he meant.
Wow.
Yeah. So I would, I'm assuming they probably evaluated that with a X-ray, like a Panorex X-ray in the office. Is that right?
Yes. It was this, it was like a scan that went around my head, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, so sometimes, yeah. You know, it's great for evaluation of the teeth, and they can see the bottom portion of the sinuses. So sometimes the dentists actually refer a lot of patients to me, you know, because they have kind of, not clear visualization of the entirety of the sinuses. So usually the first step that I would do is, you know, look into your nose and see if I can see anything obvious and, you know, make sure that, check your history and see if you have any sinus-related issues. But then usually I would get a CAT scan dedicated for your sinuses itself and just see, you know, the difference between both sides and see how patent or open the sinus itself is. So that would probably be the next place to start, would be a CAT scan just to make sure that the sinuses themselves kind of look relatively normal. But you can have, you know, patients can have redundant bone and, you know, you could, so it could be kind of just an incidental finding. And the X-rays that they do aren't perfect. Right. For looking at the sinuses right. themselves.
Sure. Okay. Great. Oh. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Mary. Take care.
So, Dr. Gruby, I mean, in the course of your day-to-day work, how common is it for you to look at an X-ray and say, oh, my gosh, you got a couple extra bones in there?
I wouldn't say that's too common, although I see a lot of unusual stuff here in Albany. We see a ton of different pathology. My day consists of a lot of different types of complaints and a lot of, and primarily my focus is on just rhinology, sinus, and endoscopic skull-based surgery. So it's there's a lot of variety to it. You'd be surprised.
All right, let's go back to the phones, grab at least one more here before the next break. And we're going to go to Chris in Housatonic. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, Dr. Gordon. And I got a question for you. Every time I blow my nose, it just happened recently. I had a bloody nose, and I had to put a towel on it for about a couple minutes. And I was wondering what that is alleviated to. Some people say it's dry weather.
Yeah, so that's something that I've been seeing a ton of over the winter months is there's a lot of issues with nosebleeds up here in the Northeast, and a lot of that is because the air is very dry, and also when you're inside a lot, the forced air generally becomes very dry when you're inside as well. So there's not a lot of humidity to your nose. So there's your nose is an extremely vascular thing, meaning it has a lot of blood supply from a lot of different arteries, and it can bleed. And when it bleeds, it can actually bleed pretty significantly. So a large majority of that is just related to dryness. And so usually I tell patients to make sure that they try to get a humidifier at night to help with some of that dryness. And also you can use things like saline sprays in the nose, which are really good for hygiene of the nose. It keeps your nose nice and moist, but also some ointment at night is often helpful. So like either some antibiotic ointment or Vaseline, if you put that on the edge of your nose, generally that's enough to kind of humidify the air as you breathe in at night. If you do have any significant bleeding, that Afrin nose spray I was talking about earlier actually stops bleeding very well. So you can put a couple sprays of that in your nose and pinch your nose if it's persistent, and that generally stops a nosebleed. Now, if you could have persistent issues with nosebleeds for a long period of time, you also do want to have that looked at because you want to make sure that there's not anything unusual going on in your nose that could be causing nosebleeds. But I would say 9 times out of 10, it's just a nuisance and it's related to the dryness.
All right, Chris, thanks so much for the call. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Jordan Gruby joins us today, back with the home stretch in a moment. It's Vox Pop. It's a Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Ear, nose, and throat medical care today with Dr. Jordan Gruby of Albany Medical Center. And a great email here, doctor. This one's from Mark. Mark writes, my dentist told me once that what I thought was a bad toothache was really a problem with my lower sinus. Can you explain, please, what is the relationship between the lower sinuses and the upper teeth? How is it that a problem in one area can cause pain in the other? And that's from Mark.
Well, that's a great question, Mark. And your dentist is absolutely right. That can actually occur. So the teeth are, a few of the molar teeth are intimately connected or, you know, associated with the sinus themselves. And one of the cardinal signs of maxillary sinusitis or sinusitis in the cheeks themselves could be tooth pain. And it's just because the relation of the nerves is very similar. So that pressure that could be generated in the sinus could actually manifest as tooth problems. And that goes back and forth. Sometimes bad teeth could be a nidus for infection of the sinus, but also some tooth pain could actually be sinus in origin. So those are intimately connected, and we see that all the time. It's one of the cardinal symptoms of maxillary sinusitis.
And this one is from Robert in Phoenicia. Robert writes, about 2 to 3 times a year, I develop a painful sensitivity where my ear meets my head. Any contact with the ear is very painful, only lasts a few minutes. It's happened both on my right and my left side, but never at the same time. Although I've never had gout, it seems to resemble that kind of pain and sensitivity. Any thoughts? And that's from Robert in Phoenicia.
That's an interesting question, Robert. You can have some neuropathic type of pain disorders that affect the area of the face and around that area. I mean, I would have to see if there was any obvious lesions or anything when you're having exacerbation of those symptoms. But there can be different types of pain disorders that could be causing some of his problems in that area.
Dr. Jordan Gruby joins us today on Medical Monday. And back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Amy in Albany. Amy, you're on.
Hi, yes. I just had a comment. Earlier, there was a call in about a gentleman who had taken a fall, and as a result of the fall, they realized they were experiencing tinnitus afterwards. And a relative of mine had had some success with acupuncture in treating that condition after they also took a fall and had a concussion. So I just didn't know if that was anything that the physician had heard about previously.
That's very interesting,
Amy. Had any experience with.
Dr. Gruby, do you at all see any efficacy in Eastern medicine?
So, I mean, I think that it can be great for certain things, 100%. I've never utilized it for tinnitus specifically, although I think some homeopathic treatments and Eastern medicine can definitely has a role to play. And the great thing is there's generally not a lot of side effects from some of these things. So definitely, if you know, warrants, you know, give it an opportunity and give it a chance, although I've never specifically utilized it for something like that.
Amy, thanks a lot for the call. We now go to Hopewell Junction, and it's Dina or Dinah?
It's Dina. Hi.
Hiya, Dina.
Thank
you're
you.
On. Go ahead.
Good. Question about earwax. I think you discussed it earlier, but I might have missed a part of it. I don't use Q-tips, and years ago, my doctor noted it, and the nurses would irrigate my ears, and I would see all this earwax, I guess, coming out.
Mm-hmm.
That's not provided now. Is there a home remedy? People say hydrogen peroxide. I'm very cautious about putting anything in my ears.
Yeah, so sometimes people do use some dilute hydrogen peroxide, and that has a tendency to dissolve some of the wax. People get very hung up about wax in their ears. Wax in their ears is actually, you know, it's a natural thing. The sebum is actually made by some of the cells inside your ear canal, and there's antibacterial component to earwax. The problem is when it gets, and generally your ear actually is self-cleaning, meaning, you know, a little bit of wax is normal, and it kind of, your ear works to kind of circulate it through, but it becomes a problem. Some people, for whatever reason, are very prone to get dry wax and can get impacted. And if it's impacting your ear, your hearing itself, now that's a reason to kind of either see an ENT doctor or your local primary care doctor and kind of get it removed. But it you don't have to generally do that unless it's becoming a problem to you. But that something like dilute hydrogen peroxide generally is pretty safe as long as your eardrum itself is intact and you know, so I have had patients use that before, but generally it's good to give an exam to make sure that there's actually a reason to be using it.
Okay, no, that sounds good. Thanks so much. It doesn't impact my hearing. I hear very well. Thank you.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you very much. Now, when you or when one has a popped eardrum, say in childhood or whatever, when that heals, I assume there mm-hmm. is scar tissue. Does that noticeably affect one's hearing?
Generally not. Generally, the eardrum is an extremely thin membrane, and it really is only a few cell layers thick, and it actually has the ability to regenerate. So, like you're saying, sometimes if you just have a traumatic perforation to your eardrum, oftentimes that just heals on its own, or consequently, if it doesn't, we can surgically go in and repair that. Generally, if as long as it's healed, even though sometimes there's a little bit of scar or maybe it's not as thick as the remainder of the eardrum, as long as that membrane is intact, generally the impact on hearing is pretty minimal.
We're joined today by Dr. Jordan Gruby of Albany Medical Center, and the number is 800-348-2551. Sandra in Adams, Massachusetts. Hiya, Sandra. You're up.
Thank you. So, as someone who tries to avoid catching any kind of virus, since I have lung problems, I've usually used this little saying that I share with people. And I say to them, if you haven't had an opportunity to wash your hands, don't touch any of the holes in your head. Now, usually that gets a little chuckle from people, and hopefully they'll remember. But I guess the question behind it is, could viruses actually enter my body through my ears? We know it can through the eyes, nose, and mouth. But my ears are connected to my throat. Is there any validity to my fun little statement?
I love that.
Well, maybe I'll steal that statement, Sandra. But I don't think the ears aren't. Yes. You know, the mucous membranes are generally the ones you think of, like you said, either the inner lining of the nose or the oral cavity or even the eyes. So generally, the ear. You are correct in that the ear does have connection to the back of the nose and also the back of the throat. But, you know, there's three components to the ear. One of is the external ear, and that's the canal itself up to the area of the eardrum. And then you have the middle ear, which is the eardrum to the inner ear structures. The middle ear has the hearing ossicles and some small little tiny muscles and nerves. And then there's the inner ear. So you have to kind of – the eustachian tube is – actually within the middle ear itself. So you'd have to traverse a lot of area for any pathogen to get from your ear down to the back of your throat. So the ear, I would say, is a little bit less risk, but nonetheless, I think your statement is probably well served.
Very good advice all the same. Sandra, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Jordan Gruby of Albany Med joins us today. And let's go to Ed in Saratoga. Hello there, Ed.
Hi.
You're up.
I thought 2 years of Latin in Catholic high school was a waste until I got to medical school.
Okay.
Then it came in pretty handy. So the Latin is, let's see, the Latin is tintinare, to ring or jingle.
Oh.
And a word that I actually knew is tintinabulation is a chorus of bells, like church bells.
Wow, it's amazing.
That's where it's from.
I appreciate that, Ed.
Hey,
you saved me some of my own homework.
I appreciate the call, and thank you very much, Ed. We go now to Hyde Park and Paul.
Hi, Dr. Gruby. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Paul. No problem.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
All right. Quick question. Due to a lot of strep infections when I was a kid, I've been left with tonsillar crypts. And, you know, I gargle nightly with a diluted solution of hydrogen peroxide to keep them clean, but sometimes they just have to manually get cleaned out. So two questions. Number one, is there anything more effective than a hydrogen peroxide rinse? What are the options? And B, can the constant, let's call it biomass that gets in there, can that cause long-term health problems if it's not addressed?
Good question. So this can be a very bothersome thing to patients, specifically tonsillar crypts, which form tonsilliths, which are little concretions of kind of debris and things of that nature. So sometimes they can cause bad breath, and which we call halitosis. But what you're doing is essentially all the right things. You know, frequent irrigations. You want to try to stay as hydrated as possible, but rinsing the mouth with hydrogen peroxide rinses or other mouth rinses are the best way to kind of try to keep it at bay. Consequently, you know, sometimes we do occasionally remove tonsils for chronic halitosis. That's very, very bothersome. Now, that's kind of – it's not a fun procedure to do in adults. It's about 2 weeks of a lot of pain and risks of potential bleeding. But unfortunately, I think you're doing all the right things. There's no quick fixes or magic remedies for tonsillitis, especially after you've had those deep crypts that form from chronic infections, especially when you're a kid. So,
all right, Paul, thank you very much. Now, why is it that if an adult has to have his or her tonsils out, it's a much longer recovery. I when I was a kid, I had the tonsils out, and I think it was a couple days in the hospital. This was a long time ago. And then one of my daughters had tonsils out, and I think she was home that day.
Yeah, we see this all the time. Kids are super resilient, and for whatever reason, I don't know if they're associated with pain. Their association with pain is as well formed as it is when you become an adult. Also, the surgery itself, generally, by the time you're an adult, you've had many more infections, and sometimes the surgery entails a little bit more in terms of just surgery itself. So I think that's also partially contributes to it. But we see it all the time. Some kids bounce back, you know, right away. And for adults, it can be 2 or 3 weeks of just straight agony.
Oh, yeah. Well,
he takes an
annual. Hello, Jackie. You're on. In Hayden.
Oh, hello.
Hi. So we're on the radio now, so I hope you didn't say anything bad.
Yes.
Sorry.
About 10 years ago, I had an MRI. I think it was for chronic migraine, and it showed that I had a polyp in my sphenoid sinus. I went to an ENT, and she said, no problem. Don't worry about it. I said, is it a cancer risk? She said, very unlikely. But then I remember reading that Oliver Sacks died of sinus cancer, didn't he? Anyway, 5 years later, I had another MRI at the advice of my neurologist to look at this, and when I went to the ENT, a different one, for some reason they could not find the film. He only had the report, but he said, well, it showed mucosal changes, but don't worry about it. Nothing to be done. So what do you think?
So MRIs can be great, and especially for neurologists, they're excellent in terms of evaluating the brain and some of the soft tissues. So oftentimes, in terms of the sinuses themselves, they actually overcall a little bit of sinus pathology. So usually the tool that I usually utilize to look at your sinuses specifically is a CAT scan. And the reason for this is the CAT scans are better for bony anatomy, but also can show mucosal thickening of your sinuses themselves. So MRIs generally can overcall some sinus disease on an MRI. And so what I would do is maybe think about considering a CAT scan just to kind of look at it. And if you're not having any symptoms and it's not changing over a period of time, I would agree with your ENTs that you had seen previously, probably just need to watch it. But,
it's not a perfect study. Okay.
Sorry, what were you going to say?
So it sounds like you're leaving it totally up to sort of my anxiety level. Because I have no symptoms. There was mucosal changes from those 5 years, but you don't think that's anything.
MRIs are generally very, very sensitive to sinus pathology. So, and when I say pathology, that could just be some residual inflammation in your sinus for whatever reason. So if it's been there for a period of time, you know, I would, like I said, I would maybe consider a CAT scan. And if it looked relatively, you know, straightforward, benign, either just kind of watch it or, you know, usually I think I would agree with the previous ENT doctors that you have seen.
Well, thank you for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jordan Gruby of Albany Medical Center joins us, and Kathy's in Saratoga. Kathy.
Hi. I have a question, and I did see Dr. Shapshay at the Albany. I have a laryngeal sensory neuropathic cough. Nobody's been able to help me. You have any suggestions?
So I will start off by saying that Dr. Shapshay is an excellent doctor. He's an excellent laryngologist. We do have another laryngologist here by the name of Dr. Mortensen. For something of that degree, I would defer to somebody that has subspecialty training, just specifically working with the larynx and the voice box. So I would definitely schedule a follow-up with one of those two doctors, and they're both absolutely excellent, and we're very fortunate to have them in this area. But it's kind of outside the scope of my specific practice within the sinuses.
Well, Kathy, thank you very much for the call, and the number here is 800-348-2551. Scott in Hudson. Scott, you're up.
Hi. Hi, Dr. and Ray. I have a question that you might not be able to answer on the phone. I've had vertigo, like, daily for the last few months, and in between that time, I came down with COVID.
Aye.
And was in the hospital for a few weeks. And now that I'm out, I'm recovered. I even got the vaccine yesterday. But the vertigo is persisting. And I don't know whether it's a sinus-related thing or something else. My GP wasn't able to see anything and was going to schedule something with an ENT, which isn't available right here in Hudson, but will be soon.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah, I wonder if you have any ideas about that.
Yeah, thanks for the call, and sorry that you had the COVID there for a while. But I think vertigo is a tough thing. It's it can be multifactorial, but generally it's not related to the sinuses themselves, more the inner ear. But you want the vertigo could also be related to central causes as well. So you really need a thorough workup, and ENT doctors have the ability to do some formal balance testing to kind of identify where exactly the vertigo is kind of originating, and there can be varying different reasons why that vertigo would be happening. So it's tough for me to answer without kind of doing all the testing that would need to be performed, but I think you should definitely keep up and keep that appointment when available, and hopefully they can kind of get figure out what's going on with you.
Scott, thanks a lot. We appreciate the call, and we only have about a minute, maybe 2 minutes left here. Let's go to Jim and Adams. Jim, you're on.
Hey.
Thanks a lot for taking the call, doctor, as well.
No problem, Jim.
Yes, I'm 77 years old, and I've been on a cleansing and alkalizing my blood chemistry for the last several years. Previous to all my life, I didn't realize I had a sensitivity to gluten. Once I got out of my diet, my mucus was no longer like almost blue and very thick. It became clear and crystal clear, and then sometimes very thin. But I've been having blood discharging with the mucus as well for the last couple of years.
Some blood with the mucus, is that what you said?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so I mean, I think, like I said, a lot of that can be just some irritation from the inner linings of the nose itself, but you really should have somebody take a look at all the structures kind of within the nose and do a formal examination of your oral cavity in the back of your nose to make sure that there's nothing other kind of unusual there. The most likely situation would be that there's just some residual dryness to your mucous membranes and some irritation, but you want to make sure that there's nothing else going on there.
Jim, thanks a lot. Now, we only have about 30 seconds here, Dr. Gruby. This email from Tom, and it's a good question. What do we do about post-nasal drip? And that's from Tom. You have 20 seconds.
Post-nasal drip is another common complaint that I see in my practice. And generally, you want to try to figure out exactly what's going on with and try to get to the underlying disorder, which was just causing some of the drip. So you have to take a detailed history. Is this an allergic component? Is this related to something like chronic rhinosinusitis? Is there nasal polyps there? So you kind of have to do a fully comprehensive evaluation and take a great history. But oftentimes, we can treat patients with things as simple as nasal sprays, and that can help with some of the post-nasal drip.
Well, you were right on the money. You must have had a stopwatch. Dr. Jordan Gruby, well done, sir. Thank you for coming.
Thanks, Ray. This was a lot of fun.
We'll talk to you soon. Support comes from Berkshire Orthopedic Associates, an affiliate of Berkshire Health Systems, providing orthopedic services in the Berkshires, including Mako robotic surgery, sports medicine, and anterior hip surgery, 413-499-6600. Once again, thanks to Dr. Jordan Gruby of Albany Medical Center for joining us. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the great calls and emails today. Sorry if we did not get to yours. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phone screened by Joe Makowitz, our producers, Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we talk real estate, and the market is red hot, people. Realtors Alex Monticello and Renata Lewis join us. So get your real estate questions ready, and we'll see you at 2 p.m. right now. Stand by for the Media Project.